Prabhu, I just had made note of a few points which I could probably ask you. Like from the beginning, you know, as to how you came in touch with the Hare Krishna devotees, like way back, and from which place you came from.
Yeah, I was a student in New York City. This is back in 1970. I joined in 73. I was very impressed when I first saw ISKCON devotees actually a few years before that, 1966, the second year the Prabhupada was in America. I saw them on television, the devotees in New York. And I was very impressed. I had no idea how I could become one of those. But I was impressed that these are some people that have some real spiritual life. But it was only in 1973, 7 years after that, that I went to the temple. Some friend of mine brought me to the Sunday feast, New York Temple. And I also, at that time, was seeing the devotees on the campus of Columbia University in New York. How I actually joined, I received books. I purchased some books in Back to Godhead magazine. I may have started chanting. Yeah, I mean, during that year, I started chanting a little bit. And I started thinking about becoming a devotee, trying to follow the principles. But what really dragged me to joining the temple is that I left. I graduated school with only a bachelor's degree and had no desire to go on to graduate school. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I couldn't get any proper employment. Mm-hmm. You know, with a degree in linguistics, bachelor's degree, nobody wants to employ you for anything, you know, any decent job. Mm-hmm. Because it's overqualification for menial jobs and no practical qualification for anything good. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get any proper employment for about a year. And then Krishna gave me employment. You know, I was given service in the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust in New York City. Mm-hmm. BBT was then located at the temple in Brooklyn, New York. And I started helping in the English department of the BBT, doing some proofreading. Mm-hmm. Even before I was allowed to move into the temple, at that time, New York Temple was a big temple, 150 devotees. Mm-hmm. And you could not just move in unless you first proved yourself. They even had a halfway house, an apartment that was a place for testing new brahmacharis before they let them move into the temple. Mm-hmm. So I was working for the BBT before I was allowed to even move in the temple. And I've been working for the BBT mostly in just that. That's my only services with the BBT since then. This is 1973.
Until now,
yes. Okay. You know, with some of the, you know, some break, short periods when I wasn't working for the BBT. Most of the time, I was just doing that service. Mm-hmm. I joined the Sanskrit department of the BBT 4 months after I joined, mm-hmm. and I've been doing service for them since then.
Prabhu, when did you first meet Prabhupada?
Well, I saw Prabhupada when he came to New York 2 weeks after I moved into the temple in March of 1973. Prabhupada came to New York, but it wasn't at that time. ISKCON was already big, and a new devotee couldn't easily just come and talk to Prabhupada, mm-hmm. not like the earlier years. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get a chance to talk to Prabhupada, but I just was there, saw him every day he gave class. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going on morning walks. I don't even know if in New York City he was going on morning walks at that time. I don't think so.
What was your first impression of Prabhupada when you met him?
Oh, I don't remember. I just remember that he had a big effulgence. You know, very brilliant. Anyway, at that time I was off the street. My perceptions weren't very clear.
Mm. But then, Prabhupada, when did you really become serious of becoming a devotee and like moving into the temple or becoming full-time devotee? When did you decide about that?
Well, that was in the beginning of 1973.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But you said that initially when you joined the BBT, like you were not very serious.
No, that was just... By then I was chanting regularly, you know, it was just a few weeks before I moved into the temple after I started working like that.
And then your initiation and all had happened after
73? It was in the fall of 1973, my first initiation.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then, having really not met Prabhupada very often, like, how did Prabhupada or his books really inspire you to keep on staying in the moment?
Well,
because I ask you this question is nowadays, like, we are attached to seeing our spiritual master and his physical presence.
Many devotees don't see their spiritual master nowadays too.
Yeah. But then sometimes.
But I did get a chance to see Prabhupada, but I didn't have a chance to, have face to face interaction with him, except for a few minutes altogether. But I had close contact with his books. Working at the BBT is actually a very intimate service. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada made a comment once to one of his editors that said, all the boys and girls who are working at the BBT doing editing and proofreading work, they will all become great devotees.
Mm-hmm.
Because having to scrutinize my books so closely is very intimate association with Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's what Prabhupada said. And maybe the words were slightly different.
Uh-huh.
So that was working with Prabhupada. Working on his books was actually my closest association. I heard Prabhupada give class maybe 200 times at various places. But the main thing was the connection with Prabhupada's words with his books. Words, both forms, in his books and in his classes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, being with Prabhupada's devotees, living with and working with Prabhupada's disciples.
Mm-hmm.
And that was adequate association with Prabhupada. I wasn't one of those who was privileged to travel with him or do personal service with him.
Mm-hmm.
Physically, but I didn't feel disconnected at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was inspiring enough to be working for the BBT.
Mm-hmm.
But also what kept me going was the fact that everybody went on Sankirtan, went out to distribute books, and Harinam.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, it was a very powerful temple. We had street kirtan every day, and almost every day, almost everybody in the temple went out to do book distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And on the weekends, the whole temple emptied out. Everybody went out traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So having the experience of that preaching activity for at least the first 2.5 years that I was in the movement has kept me going, I think, more than anything else.
But then you went on the Harinams every day and...
Yes, at the very beginning especially.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was told that probably please when you distribute books. I tried to distribute books on the Harinam.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to distribute books around the party. That I was an awful book distributor, the worst in the temple as far as results. But I did it every day practically for 2.5 years.
Uh-huh. But then how did people in New York in those days, how were they receiving the books from
the books? They were taking the books, buying them, and the devotees were very appreciated, not seriously appreciated, but they were liked. The people in New York liked us. We sold plenty of books. We would go on the subways, the metro. Subway, in American language, means the train under the ground, not the walking pedestrian.
Okay.
Subway. Yeah. Subway means metro line, the Patala Railway, whatever.
Yeah.
And we go, many devotees go out every day and sell these little booklets. I think you may have seen it. What's the name of it? Reservoir of Pleasures. Little, 20-page book.
Yeah.
We sell them real cheap, but every day go out. So people would have, 10 copies or more, and they keep on buying. We just go in subway cars, in the train cars, and make announcements and collect money, and people would buy them like anything, yeah.
Is can we? I'll have to use your computer for playing that train. Do you know why?
Why?
I need 32 megabytes video card for that, and I don't have that.
Do you mean you can't play it on your machine?
32. I need 32 megabytes video card, and I don't have that.
Did you confirm that with Dharmada?
Yes.
He really
said.
That's
what he said.
He said you cannot play it on your machine.
Yes, we went into the readme file. Said you
cannot
at least 32
video card is.
Is inadequate?
video card, it's, I mean, doesn't support. You need at least 16 megabytes of video card. And
no, at least 32.
Oh.
32.
Yeah, 30. Anyway, only an album video is supported. It's really, and if you want to use even shadows and all other small videos, then you need even 64 megabytes of
Do
video
I have
card.
64?
It's, you have enough. You have, I think it's 16 even enough. I mean, video card. It's
okay, well, don't install it on my machine, but...
Do you still have it in the machine? Or
no, I didn't install it. All I did is put the VCD.
Do you still have the VCD?
We erased it.
Okay.
So don't make it a virtual drive. Just play it on the disk.
Yeah.
Faster is enough, but anyway, if you want to use shadows and all other small details, and even on my computer, it's not possible. My computer's video card is 8 megabytes.
Really?
And this is 2 megabytes video card. Too sophisticated game, it's maybe going to be very, very...
Probably very complex. Okay.
Does this have enough for shadows too?
I can check.
What about my I'm sorry, we're wasting time here.
What did you
have? 2 minutes, Prabhu.
Yeah.
What about my other IBM?
Oh, no.
No way.
No. Video card, it's on that IBM, I think it will be, I don't know, 4 or 8, like mine.
Yes.
Mine is 8 megabytes.
Okay.
Is there any way to make more space for it?
No, it's not. It's a hardware. It's a hardware inside of a system board. You cannot do anything.
You cannot even just replace it with a new
one
much more?
No, these newest games they're requiring video memory. It's because we have...
There's no software that emulates it?
Even if we double on the Toshiba, even if we double it, it will be 4.
Hmm.
It has 2.
Okay. I'm sorry, please.
Yeah, you were saying something, and I don't know where we stopped.
I think...
And you were talking about boot distribution.
Oh, yeah, but we can move on to something else. I mean, this is the background of, what it was like in the New York Temple.
Mm.
And what you asked me about what inspired me.
Yeah.
So it was, being involved in book distribution, working for the BBT, those things what really kept me going.
Yeah, but after reading Prabhupada's books, understanding of Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I mean, not being of Indian origin or Hindu origin, people there would not know of Krishna as such. So, I mean, once that has been introduced to you, then how did you accept it? Unless, of course, you had the background of coming from that culture.
No, but the culture is not the essence.
Sense that
that's why Prabhupada was successful all over the world, because he was presenting the essence. And that is what attracts people. I was not attracted to, become superficially an imitation Hindu. Not at all. I wasn't repelled by it. I was looking for the essence. I was looking for real spiritual life, and I was ready to take a look at any religion. I looked at Christianity. I'm Jewish by background. I looked seriously at Christian, literature, and I studied it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know much about Hinduism, but I was open. I didn't care. I didn't really care the cultural aspect of it. That didn't matter to me. Some people it may matter a lot, but that's not what either attracted me, and it wasn't an obstacle either. I just saw that these people were doing the real thing, and that's what, therefore I was attracted. And dressing like this, or eating rice and dal on the floor, it was just a secondary aspect to me. So I was immediately convinced that this was a real understanding of the absolute truth and being presented very, very cogently. So I didn't have a problem accepting the philosophy. The only thing was how I could be, because of my not very good training, my background was not very cultured and not very pious. So therefore, the main problem was with my own self, to bring myself up to the standard so I could practice Krishna consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Not being brought up in a, as a vegetarian or very strict about anything, so that I had to learn those things. But those aren't really cultural aspects, those are spiritual principles.
Mm-hmm.
proper minute. Nowadays, most Indians don't follow the standards either.
That is true. Indians as such do not follow standards because, I mean, there is this concept of having so many good demigods, that demigod worship is very rampant.
But now sinful activities are becoming rampant too. Sinful activities are becoming rampant,
yes,
especially in the big cities.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's basically because of imitation of ways that culture.
Yes. Yes. See, the Westerners, there may be a cultural block, you know, that's a foreign culture, it's foreign.
Mm-hmm.
When they get over that, they can become very serious devotees. Yeah, because they're doing it, you know, having to understand what they're doing fully, otherwise they wouldn't be interested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas sometimes Indians are involved more superficially, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not much of a radical change for them to be Vaishnavas. Many of them are Vaishnavas already.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not undergoing such a radical change in commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but when someone for whom it's very foreign,
mm-hmm,
does accept it, he may accept it very radically, you know, more radically than otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm not making a universal, you know, stating a universal principle, but there may be a tendency like that.
Yeah. That's because I think in India what happens is like everyone feels that they know already about God, they know,
yes,
already about Krishna.
And they know about the culture, they know everything, and therefore they think they're already doing it. Yeah. Whereas actually there are adjustments that have to be made. And you know, purification that has to be undergone. And so sometimes someone who's already knows a lot about Krishna consciousness, is already steeped in the culture, may avoid the, you know, really undergoing the rigorous process of purification.
Mm-hmm.
That tendency can be there. Yeah. Anyway, every community, every nationality has got their own conditioning. Wherever you go, there's special problems in each place. You know, each country has got its own kind of conditioning.
Prabhu, mm-hmm, then apart from your services with the BBT, you've also been preaching. So, like, have you traveled a lot during preaching?
No. My work has mostly been with the BBT. You know, what chances I get to preach are mostly circumstantial. You know, I'm not usually free to travel. I was not able to come and live in India until 7 years ago. I was, you know, in the United States and could only come visit India for short periods. Now I've been living with my family here for 7 years. But even then, I'm mostly fixed in one place. And don't do that much traveling.
You said you were living with your family for 7 years. That is where, in Govardhan, or are you talking about?
In Govardhan for the last 5 years. Before that, we were in Vrindavan. But practically the whole time in Vraja, in Vrindavan, and then Govardhan. And not much traveling. We've been out of India only twice in that 7 years. You know, two short trips.
Mm-hmm.
One was for, you know, getting a new visa. And we only went to Sweden for that, for 1 month, to Europe. And then last January we visited my mother in America for 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
That's only the second time I've been out of India.
But actually, where did you move to the country from? New York, like you were doing your services. When did you come to
I left New York early. Yeah, the BBT moved first to California, to Los Angeles in 1975. And I stayed there for 6 years. Then, after visiting India in 1981, after spending almost a year in Bangalore, end of 1981, December, we transferred our operation. I was working with Hridayananda Maharaj on completing the Bhagavatam,
mm-hmm,
and Dravida Prabhu became our English editor. So we stationed ourselves in Miami, Florida, and I stayed there for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then moved to North Carolina, where I finished working on the Bhagavatam, and stayed there for 9 years. And only after that did I move to India in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
That was 1996 when I came to India, October.
Prabhu, you were mentioning that most of your services you've done with the BBT. So, like, what are the major books that you've already written which are published? Bhagavatam, of course, and Vyantas are there, and other books that you're, like, still writing now?
We finished working on three cantos of the Bhagavatam. 10, 11, and 12. You know, 10 Prabhupada did up to chapter 13.
Okay.
He didn't do any of the 11th and 12th canto. So that was a total of about 110 chapters of the Bhagavatam. That's almost a third. That's over a third of the Bhagavatam. And we finished that in 1988. I only first received a serious commission to translate something. And that was actually Harikesh Maharaj who commissioned me to do... Actually, I was first working on the Sandarbhas, Jiva Goswami Tattva Sandarbha.
Okay.
That was not my own work. That was Satya Narayan Prabhu was commissioned to do it, and Javita and I edited it. But Satya Narayan left ISKCON, and therefore we didn't publish it. He published the book himself. After that, Harikesh Maharaj asked me what I'd like to translate, and I had just finished reading the Laghu Bhagavatamrita, the Brihad Bhagavatamrita to Sanatana Goswami.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the book that we're still publishing. That was, I guess, 1994 that I was commissioned to start it. And I translated the whole thing over 4 years, but we're still 4 years after that. You know, 8 years since I started. We're still finishing the editing the last volume.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken quite a while to produce it. The history was I was in the Soviet Union for 2 years before I came to India, actually. I'm sorry, I left that out.
Mm-hmm.
I left America in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
I was married previously. This is my second marriage. That lasted 18 years. We had no children, but my wife... didn't leave Krishna consciousness completely, but she pretty much gave up her sadhana and didn't want to remain married anymore. She wanted to be free to do her own thing. So we broke up and I remarried in 1996. And I went to Europe and then to the Soviet Union to try to preach. I stayed with the BBT, first in Lithuania for 1 year.
Mm.
Then that BBT operation moved to Moscow, not to Moscow, to move to Russia, to South Russia. And I was there for a year. So that was 2 years in the Soviet Union before, former Soviet Union, you know, before coming to India.
So this Laghu Bhagavatam that you were saying, that happened after you did the other earlier book, the Bhagavatam?
No, I'm sorry. The Brihad Bhagavatamrita was the first book.
Okay.
That, still in production. We're still editing the last chapter of it. And I've translated some other books since then that haven't even been edited yet. There's another shorter book by Sanatan Goswami called Krishna Leela Stava. It's a summary of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice book.
Mm-hmm.
That will be the next that we'll start editing. Then the Laghu Bhagavatamrita of Rupa Goswami.
Mm-hmm.
Then now I'm working on Jiva Goswami's Sandarbhas, six Sandarbhas.
Prabhupada, these original books from where you're doing your commentaries and you're writing the translation, they are originally in Sanskrit, or there is like a description also given by Jiva Goswami or Sanatana Goswami?
Yes.
Or are they only texts in Sanskrit and then you're elaborating it? Because we never got to see the original writings of...
The originals are all in Sanskrit. I don't try to do translation from other languages. I'm not expert enough. I can read Bengali, you know, classical Bengali, but I'm not really competent to translate it. So I only do Sanskrit translations. And then most of the books have commentaries, you know, by other great devotees. Like the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Sanatana Goswami wrote his own commentary. Laghu Bhagavatamrita, we have Baladeva Vidyabhushan's commentary. Yeah, and so on. The Sandarbhas now, only the first Sandarbha has a commentary by Baladeva Vidyabhushan, and the rest of them I have to write my own commentary. But that's the first time I've had to do that, you know, to work without a commentary. But it's all in Sanskrit. You know, the original text is there, and I usually have, you know, a commentary that explains it. When we did the Bhagavatam, we were working with mainly three commentaries of Sridhar Swami,
mm-hmm.
Jiva Goswami, and Vishwanath Chakravarti.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that difficult to figure out what to write, you know, how to translate the verses. than even how to write the purports, because so much information was provided in those three commentaries.
Mm-hmm.
We simply took what was in the commentaries and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Bhagavatam, we had ample resources from the three major commentaries.
Mm-hmm.
Other books, we sometimes have to try to deal with, like the Sandarbhas, that we don't even have a commentary. But it's much easier when you have a good commentary that explains everything.
Yeah. Prabhu, you've been doing translations from Sanskrit to English and so on. But when you were in university doing your bachelor's degree in linguistics, is that when you learned Sanskrit?
No, I didn't study Sanskrit in school. I studied some other languages. I was mostly studying theory of language.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied Russian, Chinese, a little bit of smidgen of some other languages. But I never had an opportunity to study Sanskrit, never even thought of it. Only after I joined BBT.
And you did I start Sanskrit from the scratch?
On the job, yeah. And I didn't have a teacher, and I didn't have free time to just sit down and study it. It was just done, whenever I could fit it in. I didn't have much opportunity to do systematic study.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a long time. Over the course of, any number of years, 15, 20 years, I finally became competent enough to translate. I was just proofreading for 8-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started trying to translate, and I mainly had to learn it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I would not recommend this. It makes it much more difficult just to try to learn it without a teacher. But I had to do it that way.
Yeah. So right now, you've been again, currently you're working on any books?
On Jiva Goswami, Sandarbhas.
Sandarbhas,
and that's a major project. It will take at least, not counting the editing, it takes at least 6 years to translate it. And then the
six
editing,
years.
I don't, yes. Well, I think so. Maybe I can do it quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But just to be safe, let's say 6 years. And then who knows how much more time it's going to take to actually edit and produce it.
Mm-hmm. But you've been working on it alone,
Trevor? So far. Devotees, I have assistants who have helped with the transliteration, but I've done everything else myself so far. But I'm trying to organize a school that's going to be in Govardhan. We're going to teach Sanskrit, but the main focus will be Srimad Bhagavatam.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already have lined up staff, teaching staff, and so there'll be at least one devotee pundit, devotee scholar, who's actually properly trained up as a pundit, who will be joining us, who is an expert in the Sandarbhas. So he should be able to help. He'll help edit, and he'll be available for consultation on some of the more difficult things in the Sandarbhas. So when it comes to finishing, polishing it up, I'll have some competent help, yeah.
But what of the other book you were talking about, Krishna Lila Stava? Is that already over, or it's in the process of?
It just the editing is just about to start. It's an unedited manuscript right now.
And then how does it come in? One volume?
Yeah, it's only 427 verses, and it only has a short commentary, so it'll easily fit within 300 pages.
So that book is due to be released in a couple of years.
Yeah, you can say a couple of years. Next, hopefully by next Guru Purnima, we'll have the last volume of Brihad Bhagavatamrita.
Okay.
So that Krishna Lila Stava could be produced even by the end of 19, by the end of next year, because it won't take a whole year to do it.
Okay, that's very nice.
Then Lago Bhagavatamrita, and then the Sandarbhas. Then we'll only start the editing. Who knows when? At least 2 years from now. Prabhu,
you said you were talking about the school in Govardhan.
Yes.
Like what plans in that? You said you're teaching.
I have been teaching already. I've been teaching informally. I've had as many as 5 or 6 students there at a time. They come and go. Because
okay.
I don't have... The thing is, in Govardhan, we don't have an ISKCON temple, except for a brahmachari ashram, that's not available for us to use, for BBT work. And it's, strictly only for brahmacharis and sannyasis. But I've been teaching students who come and find some place to stay, and we have classes, twice a day. But now we're trying to organize, a full program, an actual school, with an ashram. We'll have a regular temple program. It'll be an ISKCON temple, small one.
It's going to be something like a gurukul, or is there any...
It's going to start just for adults. We're just not equipped to deal with children yet, except I have one son. But unless some children come, but I don't see who's going to want to send their children to get trained up as, you know, pundits, there's no, you know, there's no future in it. So, you know, it's really difficult to find, you know, young kids or, you know, whose parents are going to want to put them into such a program. Maybe, you know, anyway, we'll start up first. We'll, you know, we'll start with a few adults, and then as soon, when we can, we'll actually also have a Gurukula.
So it's basically training them in Sanskrit and keeping or teaching Srimad Bhagavatam and
yes,
teaching Sanskrit too as a language, is that it?
Yes. Well, yes, we want, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam is really our scriptural foundation. So we want to train up devotees who are expert in presenting Bhagavatam, who can, you know, can research it deeply and explain it to the devotees in the movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also for preaching. So, you know, at least our strategy is to train them up so they can read the original commentaries. So we're gonna give them, you know, thorough training in Sanskrit for that purpose. You know, it's not gonna be a Sanskrit school in a more general sense, and we're not going to you know, try to attract everybody who's interested and thinks they want to learn some Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's more. We're looking for, you know, devotees who are really serious about the Bhagavatam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, academic credentials, are not so important, but it shouldn't just be, you know, that I'm interested to know Sanskrit. It should be a real commitment to using it for preaching.
Yeah, but then that's going to be open for anyone anywhere in the world, or it's like.
Well, it's going to be located in one place, and that one place is not an easy place to live.
Yeah.
You know, Govardhan. We're going to try to provide decent facilities, but I want to make it very sattvic. You know, avoid unnecessary luxuries.
Mm-hmm.
So it would probably be too much for a lot of devotees to actually stay there. You know, the climate is severe. You know, and it just doesn't have, you know, the infrastructure that even the big cities in India have.
But you were saying it's not an easy place to live, but then it's such a transcendental place. Is it because of the severity of climate? Or the
yes.
Lack of
and electricity is out half the time.
Okay.
Yeah. So you try to sit there when it's 55 degrees in the summer and the fans don't run. It's not easy.
Okay.
And we try to, you know, arrange for some backup systems for, you know, for getting electricity, but they don't work all the time either, yeah.
Because we visit Gordon Hill just once a year, so it's
yes.
All like really transcendental. When we go from here, we're just there for a week or so, and then we're back home. So
yes.
It looks so really nice to stay there, but I think
it's not that difficult. You just have to get used to it.
Hmm.
But it's an austere place. Even Vrindavan is an austere place, although now there's much more facility there than there was before. Anyway, see, Vrindavan, it's Krishna's arrangement, Vrindavan is open for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and so all the Pesewalas from Delhi and all the foreigners, they're all, you know, there's no, you know, restriction, and they're given all facility. That's Krishna's arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Vrindavan is open. But the rest of Raja is not. You know, Yogamaya is still keeping most people out.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone comes to Govardhan. Millions of people every year come to Govardhan, but they stay one day or two or three days and they're gone. They make their pratikrama and they leave.
Mm-hmm.
Not that many people stay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there isn't facility for them to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the arrangement of Yogamaya.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that may change. I hope it doesn't change too quickly. I hope Govardhan doesn't become materially developed so that everybody just comes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the place will change radically. It won't be the same if they do. Anyway, we'll try to organize this school so it's you know, tolerable. You know, it's comfortable enough that the students don't have difficulty staying there.
And that's due to open sometime this year, right?
No, because we're just, the planning is still initial. I don't have a manager. This is the main problem right now. You know, I actually have a good teaching staff lined up, all devotees, but all competent in their specialties. One of them has a PhD,
mm-hmm.
Two of them are fully trained pundits, another one knows Jiva Goswami's grammar backwards and forwards,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I have some experience, you know, with the BBT. So the five of us, it'll be a good teaching staff, but I need to find a manager. We have funding that is, you know, lined up. We have some of the well-to-do devotee businessman in America, Gopal Bhattaprabhu, is organizing, you know, is helping to organize the management of it and fundraising. So we won't be problem getting money. We have to, we'll have enough money to operate. And we want to, the school, the idea is to have the school free. We're, you know, we're going to be selective about who we accept as full-time students. We'll check them very carefully and make sure that, you know, it's a suitable program for them and that they can actually, you know, try to... See, the main idea is to try to develop Brahminical character and train up devotees in doing Brahminical service. There are many devotees with Brahminical tendencies, but in ISKCON there's not much opportunity to do studying and teaching as your service. You know, BBT is there, Gurukul is there, but beside that, there's hardly any actual scope for that kind of Brahminical service. Preaching is there, that's Brahminical. But as far as studying and teaching, you know, and that should be a prime focus of ISKCON. ISKCON is primarily a teaching institution.
This is going to be like it's something like a course. You're saying like a couple of years would it take to complete?
We're gonna organize a 3-year traditional course. This is just initial. We may develop something else later on, some additional programs. But the initial program will be a 3-year Shastri course, like they're given the Vidyapeeth, Sanskrit Vidyapeeth. I don't know whether we'll be able to get accreditation for it, but at least we'll try to design it in that format. Very traditional, you know, no charge for tuition for those who are actually accepted into the program. We'll maintain them for free. You know, they won't have to pay anything. We'll accept donations if anybody wants to give, but we're not going to charge. It's not Brahminical. If you charge tuition, then the teachers are paid out of that tuition. Then they're paid servants. They're actually have stepped down from the highest Brahminical standard when they're teaching for pay, and then they're obliged to teach whoever's paid the tuition. Whereas, you know, one who's on a real Brahminical platform, he's free to accept only the students who he's satisfied with, because he's not charging. He's not being paid by them. Dakshina can be given, and other donors can give support. You know, hopefully we can maintain just by donations, but we're not going to charge. You know, it'll be a free school, and that way, you know, it can be Brahminical. Modern universities are not nowhere, you know, near being actually Brahminical. It's just, you know, a business. Yeah.
That's very nice. Other than this school, other plans of, other than the writing, you have any other plans?
That I'm trying to do this school is jeopardizing my translating service. So I'm not going to try to think of doing much of anything else. I may do a little bit of traveling once in a while. Yeah, I'm preaching, but not much. You know, I mainly go away this 1 month in the summer. Then maybe in the middle of the winter I might go somewhere. But aside that, I'm just completely booked up just by trying to do these two things.
Ravi, you said you came to India in 1981. That was your first visit then.
My first visit was in 1975.
To India?
Yes.
Okay.
I came to the Mayapur Festival in 1975.
Okay.
And after that, we had a Pandal program for Prabhupada in Hyderabad.
Okay.
And then we had the installation of Krishna Balaram and Radhashyama Sundar in Vrindavan in 1975. I was there for those programs.
No, what I was just trying to find out is, like, you were already mentioning about these differences in acceptance levels, you know, of devotees in the West as well as in India.
Yes.
When you preach. So I just wanted to know, do you find the change as to what you saw during your first few visits and now that you've come over 20, 22 years later?
Yes, and not completely changed for the better.
Okay.
But ISKCON is having problems all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Prabhupada was here, we were, you know, ready to save the world within a few months, you know, or a few years. We expected that, you know, we were going to conquer the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all working directly under Prabhupada. There was no other gurus in ISKCON.
Mm.
So it was very tight organization, and it was very enthusiastic.
Mm.
But those same devotees, they got married, and things changed.
Mm.
So, you know, first of all, in America, things bogged down, and now, even nowadays, it's very difficult for most temples that were thriving back in the 70s to even survive in the United States.
Can I get you some water?
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I can ask my son to do it. And now in Europe also, you know, same kind of difficulty. And that's okay, don't worry. India, I see it's different. Gurmohan?
Yeah?
Are you out of the bathroom?
I'm out.
Could you give me a glass of water?
Okay, the game is really complicated.
Complicated?
Yeah.
I'll help you with it.
I can't do it myself.
I'll help you later, okay?
I can't even...
But I'm choking here, so I have to get some water.
I can't even figure out something.
Yeah, anyway, I don't want to... I shouldn't be unfair saying critical things about India in general, so I should be careful what I say. But you know, there's a tendency all over the world. Let me not blame any country for it. There's a general tendency all over the world for ISKCON to get a little watered down. You know, the same intensity of commitment is not always there. You know, ISKCON has spread and spread and spread, but maybe it's thinned out a bit as far as the level of enthusiasm and personal commitment. Mm-hmm. I'll just say it's like that all over the world, to some extent at least. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than blaming any particular country or anybody individually for it, it's just natural tendency. Mm-hmm. For a spiritual movement as it grows older. Yeah, to start bogging down. Yeah, so I'm interested to see, radical commitment, but you're not going to expect that from everybody. So my idea in trying to do a Brahminical school is to train up, try to help train up some Brahminical leadership for the future. Brahmins and Kshatriyas, what distinguished them in Vedic society from the lower classes. Is that their commitment to selfless service. Vaishyas and Shudras are expected to be selfish. But Brahmins and Kshatriyas, to be a real Brahmins and Kshatriyas, have to have a selfless attitude. So that's what I want to see.
But Prabhu, what can we do and the common devotees now who are joined?
Gaur, please, give me some water.
Where is the cup?
The cup is sitting right there next to the jug.
How could we become, give that or have that radical change and come up with that kind of commitment which you all had then? I mean, what message do you have for us? I'm sure that now that you're saying and mentioning it so clearly, I can see that not only myself, but even the few devotees who come to Vrinda and all, I can see that probably the intensity of commitment is not as much as probably...
But it's not just the new devotees. It's not just the Indian devotees or the American. It's everywhere all the world. It's a problem not just among new devotees, also old devotees. Devotees who have been devotees for 30 years and used to be a lot more committed before.
Yeah.
And then also brand new devotees and devotees. It's all over the world. We have to remember what Prabhupada's mission is. He established this as a preaching movement. Mm-hmm. We have to work for spreading Krishna consciousness. We should be engaged in some capacity in what Prabhupada simply called preaching.
Mm-hmm.
Preach, preach, preach. We have to try to do something to enlighten the fallen, the unfortunate people of this age about Krishna consciousness and about pure Krishna consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just enough to spread. What we spread has to be pure.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to know it. We have to know what we're distributing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to do it purely. So we should, what's this formula? Purity is the force, preaching is the base. Books are the basis. Preaching is the essence. So these principles we have to remember. To be steeped in Prabhupada's books, to try to follow the regular principles strictly, and do something to carry on the preaching mission. It's one thing to have some knowledge and even some sentiment for Krishna.
Peter?
You know Krishna and you have some attraction to Krishna.
Peter, this has few countries, but it gives like 100 square meters. it's so much space. Like in the USA, it's so big.
Well, trains
you can plan
under.
Where you put the bridges and
okay,
everything.
Okay, we'll have to help you figure it out.
Every single box. Do this. Try to help me.
Okay.
And you have to also
But we actually, even, you know, just some knowledge and even some feeling is not enough. To actually become a pure devotee, you have to get the blessings of the acharyas coming in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Mm-hmm. We have Srila Prabhupada, we have access to him, and we have Prabhupada's representatives, his disciples, who are acting as spiritual masters. We have to get their blessings to actually satisfy them with our attempts at service. Service that satisfies Prabhupada the most is attempts to spread Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, passive to sitting and meditating. Prabhupada's not much interested in that. Mm-hmm. You know, or just being pious, you know, just being, you know, good people. You know, we're vegetarians and we chant some rounds and we, you know, we try not to go to the cinemas. You know, but Prabhupada wants more than that from us.
Okay.
You know, to really get his satisfaction, we're going to have to, you know, do something more radical with our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, help spread Krishna consciousness somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Be very pure. He wanted radical commitment, you know, to be different than everybody else, especially, you know, in the level of our purity, and to do something special, you know, to help spread Krishna consciousness. Something, in some capacity.
But then, Prabhu, what message would you have to... for the preachers, the people who want to preach, then what message do you have for them as to how they should go about their preaching some sessions?
Well,
and advice.
What can I say to the preachers? I'm, you know, they're preaching, I'm not preaching. I'm sitting in, you know, in front of a computer. Those who are going out and preaching, I can only offer them my respects. But, yeah, yes, yeah. That's the business purpose of our life, to preach, but the preaching has to be done purely. If there's personal motivation, if there's corruption, you know, let me just give an example. If a brahmachari, someone wearing saffron, is, you know, putting a good percentage of what he's collecting away in his own personal bank account with plans, you know, to go to Australia or America and get married, this and that, that's corrupt. You know, a brahmachari shouldn't be doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know. That's just one example, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He may be preaching, but there's too much corruption in such a case, you know, and what's going to be the effect of that preaching? What's going to happen to that devotee in the long run?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to preach, but the force behind our preaching has to be purity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, there's under cases when someone is doing a lot of preaching, but there's, you know, material motivation there, and even, you know, he's doing things that a brahmacharya sannyasi shouldn't be doing. Like collecting money for himself and so on. Yeah.
But Prabhu, what happens to such people's spiritual life? I mean, it's off the record, I'm just asking. What happens to their spiritual life?
Usually
they get
it doesn't.
Punished for,
yes, usually there's a fall down. If someone continues in a deviant way, either by laxity in the regulative principles or committing aparadhas against Vaishnavas, abusing Vaishnavas or offending them in various ways, Krishna tolerates up to a point. So after a number of years of either deviation from the principles or else offenses adding up, then the devotee will fall down. And it happens. So many devotees have fallen down. It's either, in almost every case, it's because of not following the regulative principles, or even more likely because of offending devotees.
What can one do really
to avoid?
Avoid, yeah. Because while we may not like verbally say it, but then in a mind plays games, you know. It's like,
yes.
It's nice to, know that practically if we always engage our mind 24 hours in devotional service, then there is no way in which anything else can enter. But then we are living in a world where, you know, we meet so many people. So 24 hours, mind may not be focused completely on Krishna. And
that's rare. For someone to come to that level, that means he's a paramahansa.
Some minor interaction takes place between someone and you're not too happy with it. And then the mind keeps telling you, this person did that. You might not verbally say anything or really offend him, like verbally by saying something. But it's all in the mind. So
Are you talking about conflicts among devotees?
Not conflicts, say between me and another devotee. Like, it's not.
But that's
exactly
what you're talking about,
that
personal conflict. No?
Yeah, you can call it a conflict. A personal disagreement, say,
yes,
which keeps playing on my mind. I may not say anything,
yes,
but like it's left a bad taste. And while I may go and still say Vanshi Kalgudru, it's still there on my mind. Like,
but that will always happen.
But then
in the material world, that always happens. Even among very sincere devotees, there will be disagreements and conflicts.
But that amounts to Vaishnava.
We should try to not let it turn into Vaishnava Prad. In the course of trying to serve, there may be competition, there may be conflict. Devotees may aggravate one another. Then they have to not take it too seriously. Because if we're all very strongly convinced that we're working for the same purpose, we'll tolerate is aggravating. Just like man and woman living together, husband and wife, there's always going to be conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't experience so much in India because the culture is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Marriages are much more stable. In the West,
mm-hmm,
the culture is different.
Mm-hmm.
Women are not naturally submissive in the West, and so therefore marriage is a real big fight usually.
Yeah.
The odds are against marriages surviving in the West nowadays. There's more divorce than, marriages that end in divorce than the marriages that don't end in divorce. It's the majority of marriages.
Mm.
In California, it's about 75% of marriages that end in divorce. But anyway, the point is that there's always natural conflict in a marriage. A marriage becomes spiritually successful when the husband and wife tolerate the conflicts and don't take them seriously.
Mm.
Not when there's no conflict. There's never a situation in the material world. Two people trying to work together in any capacity don't have disagreements and don't, give each other a hard time. When you have two different individuals trying to work together, you're always going to have, offenses committed will be there. But it's just, the devotee should not take it seriously. Should not be, discouraged by it. Just go on. Tolerate and go on. We should try to cultivate the virtue of being willing to forgive others for what they do to us.
Mm.
If we can do that, especially if everyone involved can do that, then the conflicts, become minimal, or the result of conflict becomes less serious.
Mm.
We do horrible things to one another, but if we're willing to forgive, then we can go on, without too much damage done. That's more. That's much more effective than the valiant pursuit of the absolute truth. I figured out everything. I know everything better than everybody else, and I'm going to convince the whole world that I have the absolute truth and end up committing offenses against everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Better is to learn how to forgive. Then we can work together.
Yeah.
I mean.
Maya is so strong, so being a devotee, I'm sure that practically there are a few things that we could do to keep away Maya's influence. Like yesterday was Nirjala Ekadashi, and though I followed it, and it's a personal experience, the mind keeps telling you, no, it's okay, you followed all Ekadashis right through the years.
Yes.
So it's okay, you can break it fast. I mean, it's so strong, though I succeeded in
By practice, though, the mind is controlled by regular practice. You observe Nirjala Ekadasi a few times.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth or fifth time you do it, you won't even think about it. The mind won't have a chance to raise an objection.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something you do every year. The first couple of times, the mind may complain, but it'll stop complaining. Regular practice defeats the mind. Yeah. So when there's irregularities, then the mind can make comments.
So, which means that in order to keep Maya away, then we need to follow a regular, discipline, sadhana.
Yes.
Rituals?
Yes. If we make it our sadhana to chant 16 rounds every day attentively,
mm-hmm,
try to do it before you do everything else in your day, if possible.
Mm-hmm.
At least do it on a regular basis, in a regular way, a regular place, a regular time,
mm-hmm,
giving attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Not letting the mind, not reading while you're chanting and talking, between mantras, actually trying to chant properly with attention.
Mm-hmm.
We're being given the minimum of 16 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would not eat in the house of any devotee who wasn't a Lakhpati, who didn't chant a lakh of rounds, 64 lakh of names, 64 rounds every day. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada had to minimize it to 16 because we're not capable, most of us, at least the Westerners, of chanting so many rounds. Mm-hmm. So that's not that much. You know, it can be done in 2 or 3 hours, but that 2 or 3 hours should be prime time. We should give attention to it. Mm-hmm. That's the first most important thing. You know, then we should also study the Bhagavatam and be careful about cultivating the association of devotees and doing it nicely. But the one thing we have to do every day is chant our rounds properly.
And any advice on how to chant rounds attentively? Because the mind is so dynamic. However much you practice it, like, still keeps moving.
Well, put everything aside. You know, it's hard to get the mind to stop. You know, coming up with all sorts of crazy things. At least, externally put everything else aside, first of all. You know, the time for chanting should not be the time for anything else. You know, shouldn't be doing anything else during that time. You know, find the time where you don't have to do anything else. So at least the external activities are under control. Then, you can start bringing the mind under control. But if you're also running around or, you know, becoming distracted by things going on outside the mind, there's no hope of controlling the mind, of actually attentively chanting. So first of all, put aside all other engagements and just chant. That's our commitment. It's to chant 16 rounds a day if we've taken initiation.
Yes. Yeah.
But that should be done. You know, just like if you're working a job, you're getting paid for money, you're expected to, at least in some jobs, you're expected to do the job properly. Some places you can get away with it with not doing the job properly, but in a serious job, so you're expected to give your time to your employer. So like that, Krishna's our employer, at least for the time that we're chanting our 16 rounds, that we should give our full attention to him that time, at least to putting aside all our engagements. Then we can sit down and try to chant attentively. The holy name itself has its attractive power, but we have to give our, first of all, listen to the mantra. As far as remembering Krishna's pastimes and so on, that will come at a more developed stage. Now we try to focus on just hearing what we're chanting. Chant it clearly and hear it clearly. That's all.
Prabhu, would you say something about how important it is for us to actually read books? Because sometimes, reading books sometimes takes a backseat. When we are doing so many other chores, chanting, following the great books, principles, maybe done. I mean, with our faith, because it's a commitment.
Yeah, many devotees may have the books in their home on the shelf, but never pick them up.
Any few words of how, we could be inspired really to read books constantly.
The things that give us strength are two of the most important things that give us strength: the Krishna's holy name and this Vaishnava Shastra, the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. This is how we stay in touch with Krishna, through the words that Krishna spoke, and the glorification of Krishna in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is considered, a sound incarnation of Krishna. And we have the Gita and the Bhagavatam presented by Prabhupada with his purport. So that's our way of being in touch with Prabhupada. Most of us committed ourselves to ISKCON because of Prabhupada, because we committed to him as the person who actually knows Krishna and actually loves Krishna, and we were committed to Prabhupada's position, status, and therefore we wanted to give our life mainly for his service. So we want to be in touch with Prabhupada. You better be in touch with his instructions. You better hear something from his books every day. That said, everyone's individual. Some devotees like to read, some people are readers, and some people are not readers. So it's not so much the personal propensity to want it to be able to pick up books, any books, and read them, for some. Or they want to read something, more read the newspaper, but to read this Bhagavatam is just too heavy for many devotees. Anyway, we should read something of Prabhupada's books every day, minimum. We should be in touch with Prabhupada. We didn't take a vow to read for 2 hours a day, like we took a vow to chant 16 rounds. We don't have a minimum vow for reading, but we should do something. Suppose we didn't have a vow to chant 16 rounds a day. And some Gaudiya Mutts, they don't. Modern Gaudiya Mutts. Some of them, the gurus say, well, just, you know, pick up your beads. Mm-hmm. You know, sometime during the day, don't let them get lonely. Mm-hmm. You know, do some chanting. Mm-hmm. And the Babaji's are sometimes practicing like that. They do some chanting, but not, you know, not any fixed amount. Mm-hmm. We have a fixed amount, you know, mm-hmm. 16 rounds. Mm-hmm. We don't have a fixed amount of reading. At least we should do some reading every day of Prabhupada's books. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just going, you know, to a Bhagavatam class and hearing it. Or playing a tape of Prabhupada, something. Mm-hmm. We should hear Prabhupada's instructions. Either read his books or hear him giving a class. Every day we should do something. You know, we hear a tape, read one purport, something minimum. Mm-hmm. Without that, we're going to start losing touch with Prabhupada. Mm-hmm. Then our attachment to him will just be sentimental. It'll be a picture on the wall, mm-hmm. but we'll forget what his instructions are. Mm-hmm. You have to hear them over and over again. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Nityam means every day, daily. Mm-hmm. So we serve the book and we serve the purpose, person Bhagavatam, by reading Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. That's the person Bhagavatam presenting the book Bhagavatam. So we should, anyway, every day do some minimal reading to keep ourselves strong. We already promised to chant 16 rounds. We should also, even though we didn't take a specific vow, we should consider it's, you know, for our own good that we do some reading every day, something.
Prabhu, you were saying that the best way to get the blessings of the Guru Parampara for our spiritual advancement is to please them, and pleasing them.
Anyway, they're not free to just bless the whole world, you know, no matter what kind of nonsense they are. As representative of the Sampradaya, the Guru has to demand that you follow the principles of the Sampradaya. He can't just save you because he's simply a representative. He's not free to change the rules. So he has to insist to his disciples that also follow the rules, follow the principles of the Sampradaya. So it's the only way to get their blessing is to serve them as they and their predecessors have asked us to serve them.
But even if one is not able to, like, physically serve the spiritual master, like, is it enough if one follows instructions?
One should do something to help fulfill the mission of the Guru. Even if you can't preach to anybody, okay? You can't find anybody who you can enlighten, you know, even the slightest about Krishna, okay? Mm-hmm. For some reason, mm-hmm. you're in a situation or you just, you know, feel so inadequate that you can't do any preaching to anybody in any form, mm-hmm. you know? Then at least maintain a nice sadhana. Okay, that's carrying out Prabhupada's mission. The people in this world who could practice Krishna consciousness are very few. At least be one of those. You know, if you can't preach, at least, you know, be a proper devotee. Maintain your vows. You know.
Okay.
Prabhupada said that. He said to one devotee, to Jagannath Sutta, he wrote the letter, even if you cannot do much to increase my movement, at least maintain what I've given you.
Mm.
So what he's given us, minimum, is the vows of initiation. We have to maintain that at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then we can satisfy Prabhupada just by doing that, because so many can't do that. Even those who have taken the vows, they give it up. So we can satisfy Prabhupada at least by maintaining our vows. You know, keeping up our sadhana. And then if you want to really, you know, satisfy him the most easy and effective way, do something in the line of preaching. Something. To somebody, you know, for somebody, enlighten somebody about Krishna in some way.
Mm.
It can be done, even by, you know, a businessman, just by being exemplary. And if people know that he's a devotee of Krishna, if he's not hiding the fact, you know, then people will be attracted to Krishna and will ask to be enlightened, just by his personal example.
Mm.
He doesn't have to necessarily, you know, give classes and sell books. Just by his personal behavior, he may be preaching. So that strength of the sadhana should naturally give us the strength to do some preaching, something according to our capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura's saying was, jivana yar shehetu prachar. Where there's life, there should be preaching. You know, if someone's alive, he should preach. Mm-hmm. So if we have any real spiritual, if we're alive spiritually, mm-hmm. it's natural to be inspired to preach. Mm-hmm. We may not know how to do it. We may not have an opportunity to do it. Mm-hmm. But at least the desire should be there, and then Krishna will give you some, you know, some opportunity to do something, mm-hmm. you know, to help enlighten people.
Prabhu, you've written now, you're writing and translating so many of these books of the Goswamis. I'm interrupting you, you would like to take rest?
No, no.
Are you in a hurry to?
No, it sounds like a little bit of flattery, that's all. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to know. Like, you've been closely studying the Goswamis' books.
Yes.
So, I know it may not be possible for you to, like, give the instructions of the Goswamis in a nutshell. But then some very inspiring thing for the Goswamis which could inspire us in our devotional service, some instructions and things.
Well, what we see when we study, all we have is what they wrote. We don't know that much about their life histories, not that much about the original followers of Lord Chaitanya. But when we study what they wrote, we see such a commitment to Krishna's service, such a radical commitment. You know, such dedication to Krishna and neglect of everything else. You know, and willingness to be rejected by the whole world. You know, as long as Krishna is satisfied and Krishna's devotees are satisfied, it's a very radical commitment. You know, and that's where their strength comes from. Of course, these Goswamis who wrote these books, they were eternal associates of Krishna. So it's not that they worked their way up to that position. They came into this world in that consciousness. You know, they were simply manifesting what was natural for them. But other devotees can, by sadhana, also come to such an exalted position of full dedication to Krishna. That's basically what it is. You know, the business of this movement is to promote the service of Radha Krishna. We're servants of Radha Krishna, you know. And we forget that, and we're trying to serve, you know, everybody else in the material world. Mm. Our parents, our spouses, our own minds and bodies, you know, our countries. But we're servants of Radha Krishna, and that's our business in life, is to glorify them and to promote their service and get other people to serve them. So that's what you see in the original, you know, devotees who established this movement hundreds of years ago, who wrote these books. That's where their interest is, in glorifying Krishna and being engaged in Krishna's service and engaging everybody else in Krishna's service. That's the purpose of life. You know, so those people actually understood what the real purpose of life is, and they lived it. You know, no hypocrisy, no compromise, none at all. You know, where do you find that in the modern world? You know, even among the devotees, we see also hypocrisy and compromise, imperfections, but the Krishna conscious movement goes on because it was founded by people who didn't compromise. You know, there was not a speck of corruption in them.
Counting going on still?
I don't know. It's going on.
Okay.
But it's done 68 minutes already.
Okay, that's okay.
That means we don't have another disc.
Anyway.
Okay, we have only 10 minutes of recording on that,
okay,
on that disc.
Right. Yeah, you were saying, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I think I finished with that.
Through sleeping and overeating, these are two things which are supposed to be our, like, worst enemies apart from, you know, mind playing games. So
this is the danger of traveling. I said, you know, I'm away from home and I have to eat. I'm forced to eat four or five times a day. And yeah.
So what could one do to actually control? Though we're eating prasadam all the time, like, how can one have control over eating and sleeping? These are like two things which are like hard to overcome.
The more you're too busy, you've got too much service to do to afford wasted time. You're not going to, you know, we just won't be able to, you know, tolerate the time wasted by too much sleeping and the health lost by overeating. So when you get really serious about accomplishing, doing something for Krishna, and you just can't waste the time, you know, then you'll make adjustments in your behavior, you know. Otherwise, you can try separately to struggle for this. But actually, it's when someone is just intent on not wasting 1 minute of Krishna's time, then he makes whatever adjustments are necessary.
To come to that level is very difficult. Like, I mean, to come to the level where we think, no, this is Krishna's time and we should not waste, because if the body makes that demand,
That's a sign of sharanagati, of actual surrender. Yeah, so it isn't. It is not easy to come to that stage. Yeah, but again, we approach it by degrees. You know, we become gradually more and more. You know, conscious of that we and everything we have, all of our time and energy, belongs to Krishna. We gradually become more aware of that by practicing, by getting a taste of how much better serving Krishna is than just wasting Krishna's time. You know, we learn it by practical experience. Then we can forget it. You know, we can grow lax as we grow older and forget what we've learned in our youth. But anyway, the opportunity there is to learn it. We should try to learn it and not forget it.
Prabhu, surrendering to the spiritual master, to his lotus feet, and surrendering to Krishna is like the ultimate act. I mean, if one does that, then everything like follows.
Yes.
How can one really get to know that he is like fully surrendered either to the spiritual master or to Krishna? I mean, where is that line?
There are natural signs. If you're becoming satisfied, peaceful, if you can actually clearly understand things properly, if you can live peacefully with the devotees, that's a good sign.
Talking?
You know, Prabhupada made a comment.
You finished?
No, but within 10 minutes we'll be finished.
Okay.
I think at least we'll run out of space here. I don't mean we have to finish in 10 minutes, but
yeah, we can.
Yes, we're what? Anyway, it'll be soon. Prabhupada, I think it was not Jagannath Sutta, it was someone else who was also there in the early years, maybe in Los Angeles. Prabhupada told him that someone must know where it came from, that your love for me will be tested by how you cooperate. So this is an important sign that we're making advancement, is that we're able to cooperate with the devotees and live peacefully with them.
Mm-hmm.
If we're fighting with all the devotees and somehow we're the only one who's right and everyone else is wrong,
mm-hmm.
there's something seriously wrong with our spirit, with our devotional service.
Mm-hmm.
That means we're not really satisfying our spiritual master. We're doing something seriously wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may be disagreements,
mm-hmm.
but when you know everyone else is wrong and only you're right, there's something wrong with you. Then, you know, something is being done seriously wrong. There's something off track. You can't really be satisfying Prabhupada and be in conflict with all the Prabhupada's followers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, many of them. Yeah. So we should look for those signs, you know, that we're actually happily associating with Vaishnavas, that we want to associate with Vaishnavas, that we don't want to avoid them, we're not hating or angry with them. That means that we must be satisfying our spiritual master. And vice versa, you know, if we're having a hard time and don't want to associate with devotees, then... we must be doing the wrong thing, and therefore we're not getting the full blessings of our spiritual master for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Worship of the spiritual master is done by hearing and following his instructions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should not be a sentimental thing. It can turn into fanaticism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's intelligent and sensible when it's based on the instructions, not just on feeling or self-righteousness or whatever. You know, it really should be based on hearing instructions and carrying them out. Ultimately hearing Krishna's instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Bona fide and authentic spiritual master is supposed to be simply repeating Krishna's instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all simple. I mean, it's platitudes, but...
Yeah, but then the further, we feel we are progressing and in Krishna consciousness, if we are, the more difficult it appears that we are going to go back to Godhead, because there are so many more things to do which we are lacking. So,
Well, we can...
The more difficult it seems. I mean, there are so many anarthas, so many things that we have to overcome.
Right, but if we're actually on the right track, then even though we find many faults with ourselves, we don't become discouraged. We don't take it as an excuse to give up or become lax,
mm-hmm.
or to just, you know, avoid the association of devotees because it's too difficult, avoid taking challenges for service because it's too difficult,
mm-hmm.
because I'm disqualified or it's just too hard.
Mm-hmm.
No, if despite our seeing so much fault in ourselves, we're still enthusiastic, that means we're on the right track. It's natural to be self-critical,
mm-hmm.
but if our finding fault in ourselves gives us, you know, means that we become less enthusiastic,
mm-hmm.
that's not right. That means that we're not doing the right things and thinking the right things.
Mm.
We should be able to see fault in ourselves without giving up, because we should be convinced that this process is potent. Krishna is very merciful. His name is very powerful. The association of Vaishnavas is very powerful. If I do some service, that will save me despite my faults. We should be enthusiastically convinced of that.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not, then when we see the faults in ourselves,
mm-hmm.
we'll be completely discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Or we see the faults in someone else and everybody else,
mm-hmm.
then we become frustrated and angry. But if we have confidence in the potency of the process and in the strength of Krishna's mercy and how willing he is to give that mercy, then we'll see our own faults, we'll see others' faults, and not be discouraged by that. Now we'll be perfectly happy to go on and persevere because we're just confident that Krishna